I launched the Brand Lab series to have conversations with inspiring executives and entrepreneurs. I then wanted to share their insights with our audience in a personal way so that everyone could learn from our inspiring guests. I'm delighted that the Brand Lab series has grown as much as it has, and it was even named the top business and technology podcast by the Academy of Interactive and Visual Arts. If you want to learn and grow with us, we encourage you to subscribe to the Brand Lab series on your favorite platform. Now, let's head back to the Brand Lab. A frequent conversation on the Brand Lab series over the last 4 years has been on innovation. We've talked with global brands like IBM, Bosch, Procter & Gamble, or industry-changing brands like RX Bar, Simple Mills, and LearnVest. And yet, there's one episode I always go back to or I'll recommend when either myself or a colleague need to solve a business problem. That is my conversation with Bob Mesta on the jobs to be done theory and innovation. I always learn something or hear something new, which is fitting, as Bob's most recent effort in September of 2019 is co-authoring a book on education and lifelong learning titled Choosing College. Bob certainly knows a lot about education, having studied at Michigan State, BU, MIT, Harvard, Stanford, and more. So let's dive into the conversation and talk with Bob Mesta.
Bob, thank you for being on the show. Welcome to the Brand Labs today.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Brian and Natalie. It's exciting to be here.
I know I talked a little bit about your education background, but let's talk about your broader background. I know you have some deep engineering roots. Yeah. So I'd love to talk a little bit about that and then kind of the disconnect, if you will, maybe between engineering and marketing.
Got it. Cool. So a little bit of my background is the other thing you need to know is I'm dyslexic and I cannot read and write. And so one of the reasons why I've studied at all those places is primarily because I learn through, I'm a kinesthetic and an auditory learner. So I actually have to learn by being in front of, I can't learn from books. And so I just pretty much sign up and am an auditor of all these different classes. And so I find something that I'm interested in or that I need to know about, and I just finagle my way in. I'm able to monitor classes or, you know, basically have, you know, sign up for the degree. But for the most part, you know, I had to struggle till I was almost about 25, 26, because I never told anybody, or my mom basically told me that should never tell anybody I have a disability like that, because she was afraid that the system would take care of me. And I, you know, basically I wouldn't be able to find my own talents. And so I've done a lot of school, but at the same time, I haven't done school in any normal way that anybody's done it. So the notion of you going back to school is actually kind of funny, because I would say, just figure out what you want to go learn, go find the person that is the best in the world and go talk to them.
That's great advice. And I remember you telling the audience at Basecamp when we met that day that you had had dyslexia. And yeah. It's fascinating how you were able to overcome some of those challenges. Let's talk about the engineering side. Yeah. You've built thousands of products, if I'm not mistaken.
So I've built and launched over 3,500 products and services, ranging from I worked on the materials for the stealth bomber, so radar absorbing materials. I worked on the guidance system for the Patriot missile. I've worked on Pokemon mac and cheese. I've worked on Five Gum. So I've worked pretty much the gamut of everything from consumer products all the way to military products to home products. I've built houses. I've been tinkering and building things my whole life. And so for me, it's one of those things where as an engineer, we're taught to basically get guidance from marketing and sales to be able to figure and understanding new technology and say, all right, how do we put things together to create new experiences for consumers, if you will. And so part of it is I'm usually in the crucible of new product development every single day. And so it's the inputs and the outputs that to me of translating what is fun. We need a fun concept that is delicious, for example. It's like, all right, what does all that mean? Because one is it's to from a marketer's perspective, to me, they need to communicate it. But from an engineer's perspective, I got to create it. So creating fun is a lot harder than talking about fun.
Yeah.
So that's really where kind of some of the methods that I've developed was the frustration of marketers to me are what I call word people, and that they're trying to find the right words that resonate with the most potential customers and also kind of build their image of what they want the brand to be. And so what happens is they would much rather have a vaguer notion of something like fun or delicious or tasty, as opposed to, yeah, I need a hard first bite. I need it to have a salty hit, and then I need to be able to have it chew and masticate into a ball, and then I need a clean aftertaste. Like, the details of actually creating a tasty experience is really hard. And so to me, it's that translation of what do you mean and how do I actually cause it? And so that's where I've spent most of my life, is translating what I would call, in the CPG world, they have a winning basis concept, and unpacking it down to, what the hell do I do?
Can you explain a little bit the jobs to be done premise?
Yeah. So the jobs to be done premise is, most people focus on the product that people buy. And so the jobs to be done premise is that people actually don't buy products. They hire them to do a job. And so what that means is that there's a situational context that somebody is in that basically is what I call a struggling moment that says, boy, I need something else because what I'm doing now isn't working. And then they have a desired outcome of what that is that's irrelevant of the product. And so the job aspect is really about what product is being put into that situation to help them make the progress that they want. And so spent a lot of time trying to understand how to specify both that situational context and the outcome that is what I call technology independent. And that helps us then be actually more creative in the technological side, as opposed to deciding specifically what the product is from a very ambiguous perspective, right?
Bob, just kind of building on the jobs to be done framework, I know that a lot of industries are in flux today. What would be another example of one where using this jobs to be done framework is really creating some interesting insight?
So actually, one of the things so a third of my business is not for profit. One of the things I'm actually working on is why is the church? So I'm working with the Harvard Divinity School and how they're getting disrupted. And we've been doing jobs to be done interviews around people who have switched religions or dropped religions. And what is the real competitive set? And so one of the things I found is that CrossFit is one of the largest competitors to any formalized religion. You find that people are literally going, so they'd say, yeah, I could make time for church. And would you ask what you got out of church? And everybody thinks there has to be a spiritual component. But when you start to look at the job it does, which is gives me a sense of community, helps me build a stronger myself, and all of a sudden you start to realize that CrossFit is doing like 3/4 of the job of church, and it's doing it way better, that people will stop going to church and they'll go to CrossFit 3 times a week. And the moment that you pull the word CrossFit out and you put in church, it literally is what church was, you know, 100 years ago.
Wow.
Crazy.
Wow.
It is crazy. And so all of a sudden you start to realize that the church is almost like the milkshakes, where they've been trying to do everything for everybody, and they do everything for everybody halfway. And so the people who are really focused on like, I need to get inner strength, I want to build a sense of community, blah, 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 it's like, yep, I'm going to go here. And so they're literally stealing people right and left. And we found all these little communities of what we call social entrepreneurs who are literally stealing, you know, if you will, time from formalized religions and doing awesome things for the world, but they have no business model. They have no way in which to stay afloat. They're literally scraping by. It's just the craziest side of the world that I'm really interested in trying to create what I call, I feel it's like Silicon Valley in 1980, right? It's like they're doing all this social good, but they have no way in which to actually figure out how to scale it. It's really interesting stuff.
I think that's another great analogy of just really explaining the jobs to be done, because as you know better than anybody, is that I think people get so focused, marketers and engineers and companies, about they think they're competing against, Ford is only competing against Toyota, which is only competing against Chevy, when they're not thinking about Zipcar, they're not thinking about Divvy Bikes, they're not thinking about Uber, they're not thinking about all the other ways.
Not thinking about Skype.
Yeah. So along those lines, and I know you've worked with companies across many, many industries over the years, do you see that there's sometimes a common misperception they might have about consumer buying habits?
Yeah. So the first thing is that what I would say is that I actually think marketers are taught incorrectly around correlation versus causality. And so what happens is they try to correlate that I'm 52 years old and I live in this zip code, you know, and I have this kind of car, that I would have a propensity to buy that product or service. And so they're triangulating around things. But What they don't know is they don't know what actually causes me to buy something today. And so what happens is they're almost treating innovation as luck. And so by doing that, what happens is they look at probabilities and everything revolves around this notion of correlation as opposed to causality. And so what Jobs does is we actually go back and we look at the progress people are making and we understand, if you will, the dominoes that have to fall for you to say, I'm buying a mattress today. Right. And so what would happen is Brian, we did the mattress interview. That's actually how we met. I pulled you out of the audience at the Switch conference, and you have now been immortalized in Clay Christensen's new book that I helped write with him, Competing Against Luck. Right. And for me, the coolest part was when you said, yeah, it was a total impulse purchase. Right. And you're talking about it. You're running through Costco with your two kids, and it's like it's on a Saturday. It's absolute chaos. And you say, yeah, we took a shortcut through a different aisle, and you were with your wife and you saw the mattress and she tried it and she looked at you and said, yep, it's time. Like, if you want this, get it. And you're like, oh, and you ran all the way back out and got the cart, got the mattress, brought it home. And the thing is that you labeled it as an impulse purchase. But then I ask you the question, so how long have you been really not sleeping well? And you said 2 years. So it wasn't a planned purchase, but the reality is, from a causal perspective, you had been trying all these different workarounds to get you to a new mattress. And it just happened to be the last piece of the puzzle was the approval of your wife around the fact okay, we can do something about it. And so I don't fundamentally believe in anything called a impulse purchase. Everything is caused, but we just might not have the perception to figure out what it is. And so we need to dig deeper. The method itself is actually built on what I call, so it's not actually a market research method, it's an interrogation method. So I went to Quantico and I learned both criminal and intelligence interrogation methods. And so everything is based on what caused you to buy that mattress that day.
So you're taking me back. Boy, that was probably 4+ years ago now. But you're taking me back to that, the moment, at least at Basecamp and the Switch conference, because what's so funny, and I've had the opportunity to, as we said before we started the show, like to see a lot of the work you've done over the years. And I learned just from watching you guys, but it never occurred to me, but it totally makes sense that you have this interrogation method training, because even though it's not confrontational or direct,
No.
You and Chris do this phenomenal job. And I know Jason has participated in a couple of these as well at Basecamp with you guys from time to time, but yeah, you guys do this amazing job of, like, one of you is clearly thinking about one path, the other one's thinking about another, and you're asking just really interesting questions. And as a marketer myself who works in the areas of co-creation and customer experience and consumer behavior, it's fascinating, because I think you're right. We're used to, and this is true whether you're on agency sides or brand sides, you're kind of used to, well, you know, Brian's demographic is that he's 43 years old, he lives in Chicago, he's this, he's that, therefore X. And I love the way that you've kind of brought some of this stuff back. And I know another thing that we do as marketers is we have a huge focus on content. You can't go anywhere now with an entire, like, sub-industry of marketing has been created just around content. But I think sometimes we make the mistake of forgetting context. And can you share a little bit about that as it relates to products?
So for me, I think context – so the phrase I use is – context creates value and contrast creates meaning. And so what happens is the phrase I use is pretty much like, do you like steak or do you like pizza?
Both.
Both, right? And so I say, all right, let's talk about the last time you had a steak. If I took the steak out and put pizza in it, do you like steak or do you like pizza?
I like steak because pizza would not. Yeah,
that's right. It doesn't fit. There's a couple of things that happened is that what marketers did for us as engineers is they actually took all the context away and they're trying to have you design the best pizza, right? But the best pizza is context dependent. So it's for what situation. And so what we end up doing is averaging things. So very early on, I actually worked on frozen pizza, right? And you end up with data that says, boy, you know, some people like thin pizza, some people like thick crust pizza, and you end up making something in the middle that nobody wants. Because you didn't understand the context of where they came from and why they hire it and what was the real competitive set. Because thin pizza sometimes is more about, boy, I want something lighter and it competes with a salad, where, you know, Uno's competes with a steak. And so all of a sudden you start to realize that they're completely different situations and completely different competitive sets. And though they're both pizza, they actually don't compete with each other.
Natalie, how about you? Steak or pizza?
Pizza every time, pizza.
Every time. That's right. That's right.
I love the context, though, because at the last time I had steak was for a nice occasion and right. I was out. And if I wanted pizza, I wouldn't have gone out for that. So, yeah.
Well, but then you start to think about it. It's usually it's celebrating. It's either with somebody special or it's with a group of people that you're trying to have conversation with. Pizza is usually more relaxing and more about like winding down. What we realize is that the experiences that we have to design as engineers, context plays an important role. Because at some point in time, we'll get a complaint after the fact, and it's like we have to go jump on it. And the reality is, well, they're not using the product in the right way. And so part of it is being able to understand what things we – like. So my favorite is Jason in his book Rework. He talks about the notion of, you know, don't listen to what the complaints your customers have. So he's had this complaint all the time that people want Gantt charts and they want resource allocation. And what he's realized is the trade-off between the facts. If I start adding all these things that people want in my product, the main reason what causes people to sign up for Basecamp is the simplicity of it. It's most of the time they've tried something more complicated. Basecamp is extremely simple. And if they start adding all these other features people want, the best users want, they actually eliminate the new users, which is where they're growing the business. And so the aspect to me as an engineer is I'm constantly trying to find the trade-offs as opposed to the ideal solution, because I actually don't believe there's ever an ideal anything, because there's always variation and there's always context that's going to change.
So the coolest thing about how you interview buyers about their purchases is that you're actually able to get in someone's head. So can you talk to us a little bit about the competing forces in their buying decisions?
Yeah, so we have this, we have a couple frameworks. One framework is called the forces of progress. So for example, I built houses for a long time. I built over 1,000 houses in Detroit from 2005 to 2008. And I basically sold another 500 used houses. So it's about 1,500 units, which is pretty good. But what we find is that we don't talk to people who want to buy a house. We talk to people who already bought a house. And instead of worried about what they bought, what we want to know is why they bought. And by stripping away the product side, because most people are trying to interview about the product, but if I'm interviewing about the situation and the outcome that you seek, I can then figure out new ways in which to innovate that are much better than where they're at now. And so we have this thing where we talk about the push of the situation, which is, you know, think of it. So one of the people we built for were, think of your parents and they're downsizing, right? And the push is going to be things like, well, has nothing to do with the answer, has everything to do with the context they're in. The house is too big. The taxes are going up. The stairs, because the laundry's in the basement. It needs a new roof. There's all these things that says, boy, it's time to move. You know, the neighborhood's turning over, et cetera. And then there's this pull. Once they see a solution, they have magnetism towards that solution. We call it the pull of the solution. And that's where, you know, I built a condo that was, you know, ranch, so every two bedroom, 2.5 bath, first floor laundry, granite countertop, hardwood floor. And it's the kitchen your mom always wanted but never had. It's all those things where they have this huge magnetism. But the reality is there's two other forces that are at play. One is what we call the anxiety of the new, which is, how am I going to sell the house? I don't know where the grocery store is. We don't know anybody out there. There's all these questions that come into their head that become a force that says, no, we shouldn't move. And then there's the habit force, which is this force that really causes people to say, well, this is where we raised the children. This is, you know, we have all these memories, all these different things. And so what happens is if the push and the pull are not greater than the anxiety and habit, people will never switch. But by interviewing people, we can understand how they actually overcame those things. And so, to be honest, at this time, I was the head of sales and marketing for this builder. And what we realized is one of the greatest anxieties was they didn't know how they were going to pack up 20, 30 years of stuff from the basement and all the closets, and how they were going to purge all that stuff to move into our condo. So what you heard was people were like, yeah, I just don't know how to get rid of this stuff. And boy, we have to cancel because we have to wait a year because it's going to take us a long time to get rid of all this, you know, all of our junk, what they say their junk. And so what I did is I actually raised the price of the condo. I included in the price of the condo basically the moving and 2 years of storage. And so what happened is that at some point I improved sales 17%, right? By just changing, if you will, it's not a feature of my house as a builder. It literally is wrapped around the solution of what's there. And what happened is like at business school, they taught me basically to get people to buy, you just add more features. But the reality is more and more features cause more and more anxiety. Like an 8-in-1, can it really do everything well? Do I really just want to get a, you know, bleach, or do I want to get that 8-in-1, you know, cleaner that's going to do all these, like, you know, it's like all of a sudden there's this anxiety that's there. And so what happens is marketers have been trained on both correlation, right, and features and benefits. And the features and benefits themselves don't cause people to basically buy. They're part of it, but they're not the causal reason. And so that's where you need to be able to understand what causes people to hire your product or fire your product.
Well, and I love the analogy you just gave a minute or two back about Jason and Basecamp, because there's so something also for keeping things simple. And I think that that's another huge problem that we have as brands, as marketers, as everything. And it makes it very hard to kind of cut through the clutter. And kind of along the lines of cutting through the clutter, talk about the importance, and I think you maybe just described one, but when you're doing these interviews, talk about the importance of finding that moment of truth.
Yeah, so there's actually two. The first moment of truth is the moment when the push and the pull become greater than the anxiety and habit. So what happens is over time is you have a first thought you should do something. Boy, I should get a new mattress, for example. And it's like, yeah, I'll look online. Yeah, I'll do this and this and this. But at some point, like your first full sleepless night or your eighth full sleepless night, you're like, all right, I need to do something about this. But the anxiety of going to the mattress store and, you know, your wife not thinking there was a problem, and there's all these different things. But at some point in time, the moment of truth when you actually were able to buy it, right? So the interesting part is the expectations for satisfaction are locked in at the moment of when people commit, right? And so if you interview people beforehand and they're what we call active looking, they want all these things, but the reality is they don't value all these things. So an example of that is in houses, we basically, people kept saying, yeah, we'd like Energy Star. We'd like it to be Energy Star compliant. We like, and then when it came down to buying something, almost, and it was about the same price as a finished basement, I literally never sold one energy compliant house, and I always sold the finished basement. And so you started to realize that what they said and what they do is something different. So you got to understand, when do they make that commitment? The second part, though, is the marketer's job is over once somebody buys, but the engineer's job now has to deliver on those expectations that were set. And so the second moment of truth is, does it act, because most purchases all happen in the mind, and they're really about, yeah, this, what I have now isn't going to work. This, what I'm going to do is basically, I want this to be better. And they have some hope that that product is going to do it. But the second moment of truth is really when people use it, and what are their metrics of satisfaction? So the interesting part is people will buy for one reason and measure satisfaction on a completely different level. And so all of a sudden, why they bought it and how they measure satisfaction are disconnected. And so part of it is we have to be able to understand that second moment of truth as well.
So you said you've designed or helped design over 3,500 products, which is astounding. What's a product that you've designed that you're most proud of?
Well, so Clay asked me a similar question. So I work with Clay Christensen for a long time, and I'm lucky enough to have 4 hours a quarter for almost 25 years with him. And he asked me this question about 2 years ago. And I said, boy, of all the things, he goes, what was your best innovation, is the way he phrased it. And I'm like, I didn't even know where to begin. And he goes, no. He goes, I have to put some context around it. You just died. You're on the pearly gates. You know, St. Peter has a list. He goes, what's the one innovation that's going to get you in? I'm like, oh, I got to think about that. And so first of all, the guidance system for the Patriot missile probably is not going to get me into heaven. Pokemon mac and cheese ain't going to get me into heaven either. And so I really started to think hard about it. And so when I was 18, 19 years old, I was an intern for a gentleman by the name of Dr. Deming. Dr. Deming was the gentleman who was in Japan and basically set, he's the father of lean, if you will. And he was 80, in his 80s at the time. And it turns out I thought he was screaming at me all the time, but he screamed at everybody. But one of the things, I was driving him around, and what happened is when we rented a car, and I was, this time I was what, 22, I guess, at the time, really. And I worked for Ford. And we'd be driving around, and you'd go to refill the gas before you turn the rental car in. And you'd literally slow down as you go into the gas station and you couldn't figure out which side the gas tank was on. And then I'd gas and I'd pull in and be on the wrong side, and Deming would be yelling at me like, this is wrong. You should fix this. This is a big problem. And so in 1987, basically, I started a little study. I was basically showing all these struggling moments around people having a hard time remembering where their gas tank was. In over a 3-year period, I was able to go to the guys who were in the instrument cluster and basically figure out how to help them put an arrow on the little gas tank that tells you which side your gas tank is on.
You did that arrow?
So I worked. That was my first struggle. That was one of my first innovations. And
wow.
So the thing is that, and I would get no credit.
You're in heaven. You're in heaven, Bob.
I have no patent on it. I have nothing. And it went from fuel fill door this side of car and then an arrow. Like, it was like the sentence, because nobody knew what that was going to mean. But if you're at it today, it's literally like almost like a bracket right next to the gas tank. And so that's the thing that I worked on that I would say is kind of like, it hasn't saved the world. It hasn't really done a whole bunch of things, but it's one of those things that it's made a lot of the world a little easier because of that. So that's what I would say is one of my greatest innovations. But the funny part is it's everywhere. And usually half your listeners are going, thank you so much. And the other half are going, what arrow? I don't understand.
Yeah, you're right.
Holy crap. I didn't even know that was there.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because you nailed it, though. Where it really comes into play is if you are traveling and you have rental cars. Because right. you know, over time, you know, whether there's an arrow or not, you're likely to remember on your own vehicle where that is. But it's crazy because it's clearly also not uniform. It's not as if it's on the right side on every vehicle in the U.S.
Right.
either.
So it highlights this is that the real premise around jobs is the struggling moment is that seed for all innovation. And so finding the struggling moments and figuring out where people want to make progress is what it's all about. So the premise of how I innovate and how I've worked on so many things and been able to bring so many things to market is I only work on things where I know there's struggling moments and people want to make progress, because somehow the world believes that if I can show them something better, people are going to want it. But the segue is something better, but people don't want it. And so this is the case where you got to be able to find that struggle where there's a push, where there's the thing that they're doing now isn't working and the outcome that they want is better than what they have now. And if you don't frame innovation around those two parameters, you're 90% of the time, 99% of the time, you're going to fail. Or at least I'll say this, I don't know how to innovate in that space. And so to me, just the notion of creating news for news' sake to basically change something, it just doesn't work. The CPG industry launches over 7,000 new products a year, 7,000 new products a year, and less than 40 go over 50 million. Less than 40. That's just dismal. And so how do we actually figure out what those are? And so I worked with Nielsen to basically write a couple of reports around what's special about these 40. Well, it turns out that those 40 were almost all focused on a job to be done that was not getting done.
Oh, that's absolutely fascinating. Well, I know you talked a little bit about what it's like to work alongside Clay Christensen, who I know a lot of our audience would know. And you were kind enough to help me make a small cameo in his latest book, Competing Against Luck.
Yeah.
And I know you joked when we were going through that a year or two back now, you were kind of joking about a couple things. So is it true that you are actually part of the whole milkshake thing?
Yeah.
So you're the milkshake man.
I am the milkshake man. I'm the one who basically went to the stores and knocked on people's windows and said, why in the world do you buy milkshakes at, 8 in the morning? And like, again, I'm a curious guy. So being dyslexic, I also ask a lot of questions. And so my mom created this thing of a 3-foot rule that if she let people within 3 feet of me that I could talk to them, because my mom was just tired, right? You know, we all have one of our children always asks a lot of questions. That was me. And so that's where I just got in this habit of being able to walk up to complete strangers and have conversations with them. You know, why are you doing that? And that's how that kind of came about. So that was one of so again, I've been working with Clay since 93 on a whole bunch of different things. And the interesting part is Clay is a very humble man and he's obviously brilliant, but his greatest gift is that he knows he doesn't know. And he doesn't try to say he knows things. He'll say, this is my best theory at this point in time. And he's prepared to have his theories blown up at any point, because you know, at some point in the 1800s, bloodletting was the best medical principles we had until we discovered germs. And we all know that progress will give us better knowledge as we can measure more. But to me, jobs to be done is a theory that's going to help us get to the next level, but it's not going to be around forever. And that's the kind of way Clay thinks as well. And he's really passed that down to me, to be very humble.
Well, Bob Masta, I could have talked to you for hours, but I knew that your knowledge around the jobs that consumers are trying to get done along innovation, along engineering, how marketing could be more effective with engineering. I knew that this would make for a great conversation. I took a ton of notes, and I think our listeners will really enjoy this. So just a final question is, if people want to learn a little bit more about you, about Rewired Group or jobs to be done, where can they go?
Well, there's a couple. One is the most important place to go is jobstobedone.org, and they need to look up the mattress interview, because they can hear you being interviewed around basically why you bought your mattress and understanding how, again, that causality. So if they want to see how the method is demonstrated, they can do that, and I'm sure we can put a link on it on the podcast somewhere for that. But jobsbedone.org is pretty much the main place that we put everything. We have a website called the Rewired Group. We basically do innovation, coaching, consulting, and advisory. We launched basically about 47 new products, 2015, 2016, generated about $2.2 billion for the clients. So I want to be able to help. I want to be able to teach. The other thing, just follow me at BMoesta, B-M-O-E-S-T-A, on Twitter, and that's it.
Thank you, Bob. I know based upon what you just described with your travel, you may not get to Chicago often, or if you do, you're in and out, but know that I owe you a cigar. And I actually love Detroit because really early in my company, an early engagement was with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. Okay. And I spent 36 weeks of my first year there. So I really have a fondness for Detroit, and it's pretty close. So worst case, maybe I'll come see you.
Yeah.